This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. For more information, go to FUBARradio.com.
Femi on FUBAR Radio.
There's no direct correlation between certain crimes and police numbers.
285 people have been stabbed to death last year. What extra funding is being provided to address the root causes of both knife crime and the increasing levels of violent crime on the streets of all of our towns and cities?
It definitely is worse if you're a woman, and it's worst of all if you're a coloured woman. But there was a report done by Lord Bew into the amount of trolling there was, etc. And it definitely was the case that women get it more. Black minority ethnic women get it additionally.
We have been engaging, Mr. Speaker, in focused, detailed and careful discussions with the union. And we continue to seek legally binding changes to the backstop which ensure that it cannot be indefinite.
Mr. Speaker, in January, 83% of Scottish MPs voted against the Prime Minister's deal. Isn't it the case that the Prime Minister has no mandate from Scotland?
We entered the European Union as the United Kingdom. We will leave the European Union as the United Kingdom. The SNP has no mandate from the Scottish people.
Welcome back to The Floor is Yours. You're here with Femi. I'm from Our Future, Our Choice, the youth movement to get a vote on the Brexit deal because everybody thinks this is going to absolute hell. I'm here joined by Ken Cheng, who is a comedian and star of the new show The Hangover Games. What's that about?
Hi, Femi. Thanks for having me, first of all. The Hangover Games is basically, it's a game show where the essential gist is that all the contestants are hungover. That's all it is. They're hungover and they have to play a lot of physical challenges mental challenges that you just wouldn't want to do hungover on a Saturday or Sunday.
Sounds like torture, actual torture.
Yeah, pretty much. That's what they were thinking. How can we get legitimate torture into a show? No, it's been...
I like TV shows that try to find a way around the Geneva Convention. It's good.
That's what all TV producers are trying to do, generally.
This is The Floor is Yours. You can text it, tweet in at FUBAR Radio, email in at FUBARradio.com. And so this week has been fun because we're going to be talking about divisions in the UK, unity in the UK. And yeah, so how much do you think Amber Rudd's comments about coloured people have strengthened the unity of our country?
Oh, it's just like every other story of this is there's extremes in response to it. A lot of people think it's completely fine. I was quite shocked that obviously as a person of color, I'm definitely not on that side of things. But you see it straight away on Twitter. A lot of people get in there to defend the comment or to justify the comment. People find excuses around it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I have a pretty straightforward policy on this one. So the word coloured is objectively racist, regardless of whether or not she is racist as a person.
Yes.
It's objectively racist on the basis that coloured comes from the verb to colour, which implies that white people are the norm and everybody else has simply been coloured in. So
yes.
it creates a degree of hierarchy in terms of races. So it's objectively racist, and you could even pretty much say the same thing about the term person of color,
yes.
Which is why I prefer if you're going to a person with someone from an ethnic minority, if you wanted to say something like that, that would work fine. But I think you tweeted earlier that it's not just the colored comment that makes her racist. It's what did you say?
I can't remember. I'm saying it's the years of her as Home Secretary enacting racist policies and rhetoric that have fueled the fans of
she's
racism.
The one that said British jobs for British people.
Yep.
Yeah, not exactly promoting unity.
Yeah, the term hostile environment comes to mind, and all the she had to resign because of the things she did, and essentially it's like, if it was just the person who slipped up, like say you were talking to someone and they slipped up, you could forgive them. Mm. But it would be a different situation from a politician on a public forum slipping up, but also having this backstory to it.
Yeah, it doesn't really help. But I mean, she's not exactly the first Tory MP to say something like that. I mean, you had Anne-Marie Morris in 2017 using the phrase "nigger in the woodpile." And what people don't know is that's not even the first time a Tory MP has actually said that. In 2008, a Tory peer, David Cameron, had to go at a Tory peer because a Tory peer said in the middle of a House of Lords debate the phrase "nigger in the woodpile." So apparently, that's just like common conservative language. And obviously, it's not just the Tory party. Labour has its anti-Semitism concerns as well. So it seems that, as much as we try to think we're progressing as a society, we seem to keep having these hang-ups, which is unfortunate.
Yeah. I don't know what it is that it elevates it more. It seems like it's happening more and more recently. Or is that actually it is happening more recently, or that we've become more aware of it because of social media now, and because the media is now picking up on it more?
Yeah.
That's the question. It's actually, are we regressing, or is it just the same but now we're more aware of it and maybe that's overall better? I don't know.
I mean, you're a stand-up. Do you deal with race a lot in your
I've become much more most of my stuff is a lot of my stuff has become more about race recently, and actually that's been a big problem because I'm touring this show. Actually, division in the UK becomes quite apparent when I've started doing the gigs outside of London and Edinburgh, which is essentially where most comedians start off. A lot of comedians basically do those two places, and you find that people just have just a completely different, just a completely different culture around talking about race. They don't have the same conversations about it. They don't know the same thing, so they're not intentionally yeah, they just don't get when I'm talking about race. When I'm talking about, like, maybe I'm telling a story about a racist thing someone said to me. Yeah. They just don't understand why that's bad.
Yeah,
they can't fathom the world where this situation is something we're used to dealing with.
That's the thing. I mean, there's this common argument that you get of people saying you can't talk about this because you're not of the right race. But there is an element of if you haven't experienced it, you don't know what it's like.
Yeah.
I mean, you as it says on your Twitter bio, you are the star of the radio show Chinese comedian.
That was my first radio series. Yeah,
and to what extent would you say that racism towards Chinese people or people of Chinese descent is still an issue, and how much do you feel it on a regular basis?
Oh yeah, no, definitely. You definitely feel it on regular basis. Online, I get a lot of people referencing that. If they disagree with me, they'll always incite race. But yeah, the racism towards Chinese is so different from the other races. It's kind of Chinese people are kind of treated as the harmless ones, but then that racist, yeah, they're like the ones over there, and like they're not bothering us. They make a lot of money. A lot of them do professional jobs. They don't have the same kind of vibe.
It's a different structure of stereotypes.
Yeah, exactly. So the stereotypes are just bad, but they're not the same. Like, people don't fear Chinese people. Instead, they kind of like leave them aside, and also, like, people are quite happy joking about Chinese stereotypes in a way they aren't in other things. I think a lot of even like woke people are quite happy to have a different vibe about joking about Chinese culture.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, each race has their own stereotypes. Yeah. I mean, but I mean, there's a comedian which I quite like who talked about a black comedian who went through a whole list of all the stereotypes against black people, and then when he got to penis size, he then said, "Some stereotypes I can live with."
Well, with Chinese people, it's like good at maths and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Knows kung fu, those kind of things, and like some of them are like quote unquote positive stereotypes, as in they're saying we're good at this thing, but it's still not.
Yeah, it still creates a false expectation.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, we're all supposed to be maths prodigies and play the violin or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, the show The Hangover debuted on the 26th of February.
Yeah, so two episodes.
And you've had two episodes so far, and the next one's on the Tuesday the 12th.
Yes. Tuesday the 12th. Yeah, that's the third episode. We filmed every one in a different city, which was actually a logistical nightmare. I don't know why we chose to do that. We had to travel for each shoot.
You're like the question time of torture.
Yeah, exactly. It was like, yeah, they were pop-up studios and just like bars and pubs and hotels and stuff. And so this one's in Leeds. And yeah, no, you got to, that was probably the first time I got to see a lot of new places in the UK and start realizing, okay, there's a lot of little quirks about these areas that don't really, yeah.
Well, I mean, one of the reasons why politics is in such a mess right now is because there's very little effort made to reach out to other parts of the country those who control the media in London.
Yeah, yeah, it's the London-centric media and just culture has just been the problem for, like, don't know, forever. Well, 40 years maybe.
Yeah,
you can trace that back, and it's just become worse and worse, and it doesn't get any better.
Which just fuels divisions. I mean, for the show, do you yourself get drunk for the purposes of the show?
I don't drink. None
you
of
don't
the,
drink.
No, I don't drink. I'm there as a. I'm kind of like the kind of voice of reason, kind of there to do. And also, I'm a bit of like the Richard Osman kind of figure in Pointless. You know, just. I'm on the desk.
Do you drink in general, though?
No, I don't drink in general.
Okay, actually, then we have that in common. I don't drink at all.
Either.
I don't drink at all.
Yeah,
so you run a show about getting drunk, and you don't drink.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I haven't drunk since I was 12. Because
12, okay. When did you start?
this sounds really bad. My parents used to make me. At special occasions and birthdays and stuff.
Yeah.
But
there's quite a lot of parents who do that. They're like, okay, we might as well get them on a bit early so they don't go crazy when they hit 18. And
yeah, I know. My parents actually literally sat me down when I was like 18 and just like... And these are two doctors, and they're like, Femi, I think you need to let your hair down a little bit. I mean, you maybe try weed.
Good doctor. Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I apparently took the whole good child thing a bit too far.
Yeah.
So in this week, we've had issues regarding knife crime.
Yeah.
Theresa May says that the rise in knife crime has nothing to do with the cuts to policing. As if crime and police have no ties at all, which is amazing. Yeah. And you had the young girl who was stabbed in the back, it caused people on Question Time last night to say that, now it's become a national emergency.
Right, yeah, exactly. That was the thing. I was like, wait, why has it only just been talking about this week? Yeah. Why is it suddenly now?
Well, what is there specifically about this particular girl?
Yeah, this and like this, like it's knife crime has been what? The figures year on year have been like pretty high for the last 10 years. And and now suddenly, now it's... It's the thing we talk about for a week, and then we'll move on to the next.
There's definitely a double standard on this thing, which isn't particularly helpful. I mean, it was said yesterday there was a teenager stabbed in West London, West Kensington, while another man was attacked within the city. 2 days ago, someone was stabbed to death in East London in Leighton. London has seen 24 homicides since the start of 2019.
Wow, okay.
Six teenagers have emerged in London, and of all of them have died from stab wounds. This is a problem that has existed and is getting worse.
Yeah.
And as was pointed out, we had this discussion a few weeks ago, a couple of months ago, with Drill Minister, and he just which made the point: if you don't invest in things that like youth centres and places that people can actually go to and engage in their community in a productive way. They're going to turn to other things.
Yeah.
If you have poverty, the ties between poverty and crime are so obvious that it's ridiculous to suggest that things like austerity, things like lack of funding for education haven't had a direct impact on the level of crime and therefore the level of knife crime that we're seeing.
Yeah, no, totally. And it's ridiculous. Like, I watch a bit of that Question Time and politicians can just go on there and say anything they want. They can say, this is nothing to do with police, or police is not the issue with money, it's the issue with how inefficiently police is run. And so they can just say anything, just move on. And it's not until the election that things can change. And even then, the election can only do so much. So it's like, what? People are, it's just one of many issues of the government where they're just dropping the ball, and they can continue to until something eventually,
ahead. And the thing that we're seeing, one of the reasons why the Brexit vote happened, I mean, you can pretty much trace where the Remain vote was based on where there were pret-a-mangers. It's the poor areas of the country is the vote for Brexit. Yeah. The tie between austerity and the impact on people's feeling of unity in the UK. I mean, our country is geared towards London. Mm. Even this effort, this so-called effort to make the country less London-centric, HS2.
I mean,
fuck's sake, that is basically a train from everywhere to London.
Yes.
Which by definition makes us more London-centric. Mm.
Exactly.
Even when you look at the stage two of things, it's still like from northern cities down. Nothing east-west.
No, it's impossible to get across.
I mean, I had to take a. I've been to Edinburgh twice in the last year, and both times I wanted to go down to Sheffield to see my parents.
Right,
But then I realised that it actually cost more to go from Edinburgh to Sheffield than from Edinburgh to London.
Yeah, bloody hell. Yeah, no, exactly. Our country, just the lack of infrastructure is just something that everyone dropped the ball. Like, it's not even a party thing. Mm. Everyone dropped the ball for the last 4 years. It's like no one even thought about it. No one cared. Our whole culture didn't really care about it. Like 20 years ago, no one was talking about these things that need to be solved then. And now we're seeing it all come apart. And it's hard to know how we stop this, because we're talking about unity and then it's just getting wider and wider. Yeah. And what is the solution at this stage?
The solution has to be investment in those areas, because if you live in Sunderland, Hull, Swansea. I mean, to go from Swansea to Bangor, so from the southwest of Wales to the northwest of Wales, and you put on Google Maps to take you to there via public transport, it takes you via Shrewsbury.
I was in Shrewsbury on Wednesday for a tour, and that is very out of the way. Yeah,
you have to literally go via England to get to another part of Wales. That is the level of which, I mean, if you live in places like that, are you going to feel like the political system actually cares about you? No. Mm. And so UK unity is being ripped apart by the absolute lack of care for people in those areas.
Yeah, and so it's happening across all things. Like, so there's the London versus anti-London division. There's age division. There's just all sorts of like different political leaning. Everything's getting wider and wider. It's actually a very scary time, and see how wide. How far apart everyone's opinions on things are. Mm. Like now people are more they've doubled down on certain opinions which aren't actually even extreme, they're just opinions.
I mean, politics has gotten so broken that you're either with us or against us, and it's just been so polarized, and the politicians are trying to make it as polarized as possible, because they know that if politics stays polarized, well, to quote Littlefinger from Game of Thrones, chaos is a ladder. They know that if we stay in this absolute chaos, I mean, Michael Gove, Boris Johnson, all these figures have, Jacob Rees-Mogg, have all used this chaos to become national figures.
They become popular on their own side, and I think that's quite a exploitative thing. And I think a lot of it is that, because like the referendum itself created this choice between two very different things, and the idea that whichever one got 50.1% of the population agreeing with it, that was the thing we have to do. And if you think about any decision in real life, like let's say you lived in a flat with 10 people or 11 people, and 6 people really wanted this thing and 5 people didn't, you wouldn't just go ahead and do it. You would find a compromise. You wouldn't create that option of just like, oh, this is the thing which will just really appeal to one group and then the other group will really hate. And so we are, but all our politics, the way the voting works, it is all about 50%. It's all about the one pie, which gets slightly more, and then, okay, everyone else has to deal with that pie.
But there's a screwed up thing. They keep saying that, I mean, Michael Gove says that even suggesting that there might be a new referendum is calling people stupid. Whereas in 2016, let's be really, really clear on this, Brexit was 4 words, leave the European Union. Right now, it's a 585-page treaty. It's a fundamentally different question.
It's just such a crazy world. We actually got sucked into it in the first place. The politicians just decided, okay, that was the best option for their own benefits. And companies as well. Companies on either side really pushed it. And everyone just now has an opinion on it because it's become such a symbol. Mm. It's become a symbol for that division.
So Ken, what do we have to look forward to in your show on Tuesday?
So yeah, there'll be a lot of basically hungover people making fools of themselves. I think we don't drink, but people who've ever had a hangover and thought, what is the one thing I wouldn't want to do? I'll get dragged into a game show and have to answer questions about the last night and all that and drink.
Well, that is a beautiful thing for people like us who don't drink. I mean, I got to see the worst of what my housemates had to go through in terms of alcohol.
That's essentially my role in the show. I'm doing that.
Well, one of my flatmates once came home late night at 3 a.m. in the morning, stumbled up the stairs. I heard him. I had to carry him up, put him in his bed, tuck him under the sheets, and then his laptop was on the computer chair, on the swivel chair next to his bed. And so I put that on the table. I was like, "Don't kick that while you're sleeping." And he put it back. I was like, "All right, no, dude, he needs to go on the table." And he put it back. And then I was like, "All right, fine, screw it." In the morning, I come around when he's completely hungover. He's on the phone to PC World trying to figure out how to get piss out of a laptop. So I'm hoping for similar shenanigans on hangover games.
Coiling up companies, that would be great. Piss in a laptop, that's what we need. If there's an X series, that would be the...
But Ken Cheng, thank you very much. Your show, The Hangover Games, is on Tuesday at...
10 p.m.
10 p.m. E4. On E4. Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Fubar Radio presents...
We're joined now by Jamie Hensley.
My only knowledge of Union J was I thought they were a pretend band in Kick-Ass. I didn't know it was
Kick-Ass, no, absolutely, nor did the whole world. And then our management and our label were like, "Oh, by the way, you're going to be in Kick-Ass." And I was like, "How? How on earth are you going to fit us in?" I think basically they wanted One Direction. I think One Direction got a little bit too big to do it. So they're like, "Right, so let's get another boy band." But wasn't really going to do anything for us to broaden our horizons. But I think we missed a trick of going over there and promoting it, being like, "Oh, yeah, we are a British band." Yeah. Everyone just thought we were actors playing a cheesy boy band.
That's what I thought.
Every Monday.
Ian Boltsworth.
From 2 p.m.
FUBAR Radio.
Primary school children in the UK are to be taught compulsory lessons about gay and transgender relations, despite a petition now signed by thousands demanding an opt-out right. It's part of a plan by the government to overhaul sex education in the country generally, but the decision has provoked fiery debate.
It's about promoting homosexuality. They should learn about it at an older age, not right now, because they can easily get influenced.
They teach kids to stay with boys and boys, and that's not a good thing.
It's opposite to our religion. We don't like it.
The Equality Act obviously clearly says you can't discriminate against religion and whatnot, and that's what they're doing. It's 99% Muslim. It's not about being Muslim. The Jewish community, the other communities, the Christian communities, they all have issues around the way things are being done.
We said all parents are on board with it, but the reality is no parents are on board with
it. How old's your child?
10.
And they're coming home, and what they're saying to you?
They're confused about homosexuality. We have nothing against Mr. Moffat. We're as British as they come. You know, we respect the British values and everything. But the problem is, he's not respecting our ethos as a community, as one. They say we work with the parents, we listen to the parents, but this is not what they're doing.
Do you think it's right to promote LGBT in the classroom?
I just don't see the point. Why? We don't send our children to school to learn about LGBT. We send them to school to learn about math, science and English.
So yeah, that was people complaining about homosexuality, LGBT issues being taught in sex education in school. Okay, so we're joined by Dominique from Ladies for Leave and also from Turning Point.
Yep.
And we're also joined by Jermaine Jackman, former winner of The Voice, mm-hmm. And artist and activist.
Yeah.
Welcome to the studio.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
So, yeah, those people were complaining about teaching LGBT issues in school because then that will influence them or whatever. I'm curious about how many gay people have been taught into being straight. If they think that exposing heterosexual kids to information about being LGBT is going to somehow turn them all gay. I'm not seeing it happen the other way around. It seems that their logic might be slightly flawed.
Well, initially, I did have some reservations about this being introduced into the curriculum. Just because a part of it was teaching 5 and 6 year olds about things like gender identity, which I personally think that should be reserved for parents to explore with their own children rather than it being force-fed by the state. However, after seeing the video of the parents outside of the school chanting really aggressively, you know, in inferring that the head teacher was interfering with Islam, I do think that some form of basic same-sex relationship education would be necessary in that school after having seen the video, if I'm being honest.
Joanne?
It brings in, for me anyway, it brings into question the role and the place of the Islamic faith in a very progressive country that we have today. And I know so many progressive Muslims, and I think it's important that we are teaching our young people and our children about the world and about the people in the world, and that we should love and respect one another despite how who they love and how they feel. And I think it's important that young people, if they're wanting to get into any industry, that they should learn and learn to accept that from a very young age. And I think it's quite, I can't really put my mind into the bodies of those mothers and those fathers, but I think it's quite a dangerous precedent if we're starting to pull LGBT lessons from the curriculum because it's conflicting with faith.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, the way we're taught about the world and people and gender roles and that sort of thing, it forms how we are today. I mean, this today, because it's International Women's Day, I tweeted about how the fact that we encourage our sons, our little boys, to pursue physical strength to a greater extent than we encourage our little girls, our daughters, to do that, it just emphasizes it. It's basic. If you're a parent and you make that choice, you're basically pretty much saying, I'm okay with one of you being less able to defend yourself in future.
But where's that happened, though?
Pardon?
Where's that happened? Like, where girls are not encouraged to participate in sport?
Pursue physical strength. There's a difference between physical strength and as in...
Terms of physical strength, like in terms of...
As in, you tell your boys to grow up to be big and strong. That happens to a significantly lesser extent with daughters.
Just in society as a whole, anyway, with action figures and the world and the way the world is set up, it's basically promoting the idea of masculinity and how men need to be strong, have massive muscles, and be very manly, and women should be in the kitchen. I don't agree with it because I took up food technology guy because I love cooking. Where do we stop? Where do we start and where do we stop?
I think that's a bit of an exaggeration, if I'm being honest. I think we've seen currently that there is a lot more encouragement for women to be strong. So, for example, there are a lot more strong female characters in the media. I mean, I'm not sure where I've seen the narrative that women should stay in the kitchen in 2019. I think that's a bit of an exaggeration.
You can see it on the commercials. You see it on TV. You see it in soap operas. You see it on a daily basis. I don't agree with it. I think the narrative needs to change. And I think it should be across the board. Everyone can be in the kitchen regardless if you're a man or a woman, and you can pursue to be a strong weightlifter if you're a man or a woman, or carry or be able to pull a plane. You know, when they got the world's strongest men, what about the world's strongest women?
Yeah.
And shout out to all my women on International Women's Day. Just wanted to put that out there.
Exactly. I mean, the image of the ideal woman is always significantly less likely to have muscles or appear physically strong in the media than what you would expect of your typical male man.
Well, that's because men are naturally stronger than women, though.
Yeah, but the fact is it's disproportionately so. If men and women were taught to pursue physical strength from an early age to the same extent, there would still be a difference, but it would be a smaller difference.
I just don't know. I think that it is a bit exaggerated. I mean, we see more women in university than boys, especially in education. It's white working class boys that are at a greater disadvantage as girls. For example, even the Gillette advert, where that was a strong message to men, really quite against masculinity, in my opinion. But, you know, I think that does demonstrate that there are big steps that we're taking as a society to kind of combat that skewed perception of gender.
We're definitely taking
but
steps.
But then do situations such as removing LGBT lessons from the curriculum, does that then take us a step backwards?
Yeah, I think in a way it does, just because of the reaction of the parents. I think that the government should stand with the school on this issue because, ultra-conservative religion in the UK doesn't really have a place. We are a liberal country, and I do think that the government should stand with the school on yeah. that issue.
Agreed. I agree. And it's obviously it's not just ultra conservative Islam. There's also ultra conservative Christianity. Yeah. And I've actually got a thing about Christianity because I was staunchly Christian until about the age of 21, mm-hmm. and so I basically found a way of reconciling my not wanting to be homophobic with my Christian faith, and that was basically by saying that if we accept that homosexuality isn't a choice. Because who would choose to be something that faces so much stigma that we had to invent a literal word for it?
Yeah.
Then, if we were to call homosexuality a sin, then that would mean that sin is something that can be involuntary and permanent. Now, if sin is something that can be involuntary and permanent, then what the hell did Jesus die for? Mm-hmm. The whole point of Jesus dying was to remove sins, which means that logically, within the scope of Christianity, it doesn't actually make sense to call homosexuality a sin.
Do you describe yourself as a Christian?
I was, up until about when at the age of 21.
And so. What do you describe yourself as now?
I guess, I mean, the logic behind intelligent design still holds true for me, mm-hmm. so I guess there's probably something, but I haven't been able to pin it to a particular religion yet.
I'm like you. I say I'm very spiritual, very faithful, yeah. very spiritual. I believe there's a higher being, and I believe that there's a afterlife, and there's a grand scheme. Mm. There's a much bigger thing happening in play. Mm. All the nuts and bolts and the detail of the Bible, I'm a bit but yeah. the overall message of love and respect needs to come through, mm. and I think that is spoken about in every single religious book,
yeah.
every single faith, and I think especially with this situation with the LGBT lessons, mm. it needs to come through with that.
Yeah,
focus
yeah.
on love and respect of other people, whether you see yourself as gender neutral, whether you're trans, whether you're a lesbian, gay, whatever, mm. love and respect is first and foremost. And you're not fighting people to try and get it off the curriculum. What are you so insecure about? What are you so scared about?
Exactly.
What are you yeah. so scared about?
Exactly.
And that's my question. What are those parents, why are they so insecure and what are they scared about? That's and true. it shines a light on people's internalized homophobia. Mm. Oh, no, I'm not homophobic, but I don't want my child learning about LGBT. Well, no, you can't put it in the same sentence.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry.
So we did actually a poll. The UK is more divided than ever. What is the solution? So we had 1% of people saying that there should be a team huddle. 3% saying that politicians should just buckle up. Mm-hmm. 16% just said, well, I guess we should go with Mars then. And then 80% supported another referendum. Now, that might have been skewed because I retweeted it.
I think it might have been. Right.
So I was part of the 16% for going to Mars because I'm like, I'm ready to jump ship. I'm just ready to go. Okay.
What would you say is the answer to the divisions in the country right now?
In terms of Brexit or just anything?
Anything.
Well, yeah. Let's go with the political discord, which is largely sort of centered around Brexit. What do you think is the best way to heal those divisions?
I think the best thing for politicians to do to heal the divide in the country would be to listen to the people. Mm. And in my opinion, well, not even in my opinion, just factually, the people voted to leave the EU. Mm. And I think there's a lot of, you know, diving around the issue, trying to worm our way out of it, you know. Mm. The people want this, the people want that. Oh, old people controlled the referendum, so therefore we need a new one because some of them are dead. Mm. That kind of thing. That is just making people infuriated, and especially if the Prime Minister does decide to extend Article 50, not to implement changes to the backstop, but simply to long the decision-making process out even further. That isn't what people want. What people want. People want the politicians to just get on with it and deal with the decision that was made in 2016, in my opinion.
So in 2016, the referendum ballot paper said leave the European Union. Yeah. It was four words, very simple words. And we've just negotiated. We've just spent two and a half years trying to find out exactly what that's going to entail. So instead of it being four words now, it's now a 585-page treaty. Mm-hmm. A treaty that most people who voted for Brexit absolutely hate. Yeah. Because when we tour the country asking people who voted for Brexit what they wanted from Brexit, largely it was about sovereignty, control. And we've now got a deal that does mean we leave the European Union, mm-hmm. but it means less sovereignty. Now, the reason why that's happened is because we signed a blank check in 2016. As I said, that we signed a contract and they wrote the term 3 years later and people don't like it. Now, the question was, it was made binary because they wanted to make it binary, but the question was, what relationship do we want to have with the other 27 countries of the EU? And our current relationship has a 48% approval rating, but we didn't know what the new relationship was going to be. Now, given that that new relationship has now been discovered, and it seems that there's opposition to it from both sides of the divide, I think the most logical thing is to ask people what they think now. Because otherwise there's a risk that we go ahead with Brexit and it ends up with something that both Leavers and Remainers don't like.
Well, I think that's a bit of a misunderstanding, because at the end of the day, during the referendum campaign, it was set out clearly what that future relationship would look like by the official Leave campaign and both the official Remain campaign as well. Prominent Remainers said, you know, this is your vote and you only get one vote on this. You know, you need to come out, vote and make your decision. And people made that decision. It's the politicians in Parliament who, you know, can't seem to fathom why people would vote to leave the EU that are making this process increasingly difficult. I mean, you've got Remainers like Anna Soubry, who has a Leave constituency, yet at every turn she sought to frustrate negotiations and to frustrate the Brexit process, yet in the same breath she's gone off to join the independent group. Well, surely your constituents should also have a people's vote, seeing as the circumstances have now changed on your opinion of the Conservative Party and their policy of Brexit. Surely that's hypocritical.
You mentioned that the official Leave campaign made it very, very clear what Leave would look like.
Yeah.
Michael Gove, one of the key figures of Vote Leave, said, in fact, he said, during the referendum, he said that we would have a free trade and fair cooperation arrangement. About a week and a half ago on Mar, he said, you're talking about no deal. This was never about no deal. We were always, during the referendum, campaigning for a deal. That is the head of the Vote Leave campaign. And then you've got Daniel Hannan, one of the chairs of Vote Leave, who also said, absolutely nobody is talking about threatening our place in the single market. So we've got the key figures of the official Leave campaign saying that Brexit was always going to be about a deal.
Can I just jump in? Mm-hmm. Throughout this whole entire conversation, the Brexit conversation, people said things they didn't know what they were talking about. People were trying to be a part of a thing that they didn't know what actually meant. No one actually knew what Brexit actually meant before the referendum, during the referendum, and after the referendum. No one actually knows. And I said this on this radio station when I was last here, that it should have never been, do you want a Theresa May Brexit or a Jeremy Corbyn Brexit? It should have been a Team UK Brexit. It should have been across political parties, everyone come sit around the table, what do we want out of this? We signed up to this EU together, we will leave this EU together, and we can make sure that every region of this country can benefit from Brexit. It's gone down the wrong route. We never had a conversation. And this is the culture within Britain, in my opinion anyway. We don't ever conversate about things, about issues. We brush them underneath the carpet and just try and turn the blind eye and hope that somehow it will go away. But then it piles up. And this is why a large part of me and a growing part of me is supporting the second referendum. It's about, okay, we can no longer decide for ourselves in Parliament. We need to have a conversation with the rest of the population and say, have we got this right? If we haven't got it right, tell us what we need to do. There should be another department set up, the people's policy. I've already dreamt about this and thought about this. The people's policy, where they contribute to what they want to see in this Brexit deal.
But
it's coming from the people.
But do you understand that that has happened in other countries as well? This is a trend when it comes to the European Union with referenda. When there's a decision that they don't like, they make people vote again.
Wait, who makes people vote again?
We've seen it.
Who makes people vote again?
The government, the pro-EU government, and the European Union also encourages it as well. We've seen it in Denmark. We've seen it in Ireland. We've seen it in France. We've seen it in lots of other countries where a decision is ignored and people are made to vote again.
But we've already established that it is possible to leave the EU on terms that most Brexit voters don't like.
Now, no, but you've got to understand that this is something that a Remainer Prime Minister has pushed onto Parliament to appease both sides. You talked about cross-party consensus. This has been attempted numerous times, and all sides are pushing things that, you know, they want without actually wanting to actually compromise. I think the Malthouse compromise was a step towards that. So people conceded that, you know, yes, we will have to be continuing to pay money to Brussels. However, you need to sort out the issues with the backstop. And the EU has made it clear that, you know, they don't want to compromise with that. So for me personally, I think the next step is to pursue no deal. There is
so
no
even though the vast majority, even though,
Sorry.
even though, even though, so In this conversation, you've said that the Leave campaign, the official Leave campaign, made it very, very clear what Leave would look like. And I just pointed out that the heads of the Leave campaign all said we leave with a deal.
Well,
and now you're saying,
Can I finish?
You said that the Leave campaign made it very, very clear what it would look like.
Well, they did.
And then I said that, and I pointed out how the Leave campaign made it very, very clear we'd be leaving with a deal. Now you're saying that we should leave with no deal, which means you're supporting something that you know the Leave campaign was not promising.
Because everybody wanted a deal, and that deal would materialise itself into, you know, continuing to trade with Europe, continuing to be close friends with Europe, but not being stuck in Europe, which is what this deal actually does. You know, it, you know, keeps us effectively in the customs union, which is something David Cameron, who was the head of the official Remain campaign, said would not happen. He said leaving the European Union means leaving the single market
and leaving the
customs union. They didn't say the opposite.
Such
as Boris Johnson said that we would be leaving the customs union and leaving the single market. Theresa May, who is a Remainer herself, said that what people wanted for Brexit was leaving the customs union and leaving the single market. And what her deal actually does is, well, she says it does one thing, but then it does another, because effectively we'd be stuck in a customs union indefinitely.
But as I just mentioned, Daniel Hannan said we'd stay in the single market. Nigel Farage said, wouldn't it be terrible if we were like Norway?
He wasn't a part of the official Leave campaign.
Okay, but Daniel Hannan was one of the chairs of the Vote Leave campaign, so he said we'd absolutely definitely be staying. But my main point here is, this is about the divisions in the country. Now, when we tour the country, we find out one of the large reasons why people voted for Brexit was because we have a deeply unequal country. Mm. We have a country that focuses largely on investment in Westminster, and we have a country that does not care about places like Hull, Sunderland, Swansea, Redcar.
I could agree with that.
Now, that is something that desperately needs to change.
Yeah.
Right.
And as I mentioned before, people voted for Brexit largely expecting a deal because that was what was promised by the Remain campaign. Now, if you live in Sunderland, for example, an area that voted for Brexit, and you know that 70% of the cars that the Nissan factory there produces go to other EU countries, and you know that there are 35,000 jobs across the northeast that depend on that factory, and you know that if you own Nissan and you can choose between having your factory in the UK, where 70% of your cars will then face a cost if there is a barrier between us and the EU, or having it in Frankfurt, where only 30% of your cars will face a cost, you know what happens to those jobs mm-hmm. in those areas that voted for Brexit. Mm-hmm. So they need things to get better. They need investment in their area. They need a better transport infrastructure. They need to get the HS2 is not what they need. They need east-west transport to actually fix that, create a thriving northern powerhouse, a real economy independent of London. That is what they need. And right now, they're not getting it. Right?
I think those issues will still be there after Brexit. When we, if we were to ever leave the EU, those issues will still be there. And Brexit is just another one of those things that we're going to... Okay, cool, everyone voted for this. We're just going to brush the issues under the carpet. Everything's been dealt with. No, people are still upset about immigration. People still feel neglected in parts of the country. Mm-hmm. People still feel ignored. People still feel like they're not part of the national conversation. Mm-hmm. It's about going out across the country, not just doing PR stunts that that Theresa May's trying to do. It's not about saying, oh, I'm going to invest $1.9 billion mm-hmm. Into the north and other regions of the country, because that was a joke in itself. I was going to say something else, but never mind. But I just feel like we need to have a proper conversation, and it's time to open up those wounds, the historical wounds. Yeah. I'm talking about not just Thatcher, but before Thatcher.
Since Jarrow.
Right, it's about opening those wounds and talking about the issues that affect so many people around the country. And the reason why I was so hesitant to support a second referendum for so long, because you never seen me come out in support, and a lot of people have said, Jermaine, why are you supporting a second referendum? It's not until I left London to study at Leeds University until I realised that not everyone in the country thinks like Londoners. And I was really conscious of the fact that it's easy for me as a Londoner to live in my London bubble and say, we need to remain, there should be a second referendum. But there are people in the country who really hate the EU, who really don't like the situation that they live in. And it's for us, and it's for politicians, to go out into those parts of the country and say, you know what, don't confuse your Tory woes with the EU. You're confusing the two. You're confusing Thatcher with the EU. You can infuse in the damages that she's made to the North with the EU. Let's have a proper conversation. Let's have real investment in those areas, and let's raise those families and those hardworking people up and out of poverty and deprivation.
That is the only way this country fixed. We need serious investment in those areas, because the narrative that we have to have is a Project Hope. Enough Project Fear. Those people feel that they have nothing left to lose. Mm-hmm. What they need is investment in those areas. That's the only way we can possibly move forward. Guys, thank you very, very much for coming on this show. This has been...
Thanks for having me.
It's really essential, because our country is so divided, and I think you'll agree with me. If Brexit stops and we have a bunch of cocky Remainers going on TV saying we won, we're screwed. We need to have a national conversation where we treat each other with respect. Remember that we all want the same thing.
It won't stop with Brexit. It will not stop with Brexit. Yeah. It will continue. And in my opinion, things will get worse.
I'm not sure things will get worse, because at the end of the day, the thing that would make things worse is actually people have voted once and then you going back to them and telling them to vote again. Because the real aim of forcing people to have a second referendum would be to remain in the European Union, would it not?
Well, given that we have a leave option, we spent 3 years negotiating, is something that most people voted for Brexit don't like.
But for many leavers, that's not a leave option. A majority of people in the Tory party would prefer no deal. And there is no majority for a second referendum in Parliament.
What would you like to see on a second referendum?
I would like to see, if there were a second referendum, I don't want one. I would like to see either Theresa May's deal or no deal and go from there. If people decide that they want Theresa May's deal, then okay. But if people decide that they want no deal, then in my opinion, that would be great. And that's something that I would be involved in campaigning for.
Okay,
guys, thank you very much for coming on the show. That was Dominique and Jermaine Jackman. Thank you very much for being here. We've got a couple of tweets. We've got Mickey Stand Up for Brexit, who says respect the democratic choice and get on with Brexit. We've also got Neil, who says, and also I think you mean more visibly divided. I don't think the Brexit vote particularly increased division. It just drastically highlighted it. Mm. I think that's 100% true.
Right.
So we've got a clip here from Annie Lennox on International Women's Day. Have a listen.
On the 8th of March, we celebrate International Women's Day. It's a day that acknowledges the amazing accomplishments of women from all over the world. It's a significant day for all women that have been working to try to make change in terms of gender equality all around the world. And it's a day when we can gather together, we can have events, and we can give the focus to the fact that there is so much disparity all around the world in terms of empowerment for girls and women. The women's movement is a global movement that has been going on since the suffragettes' time. Yeah. And each one of us can become an agent for change in your own way. This term, feminism and feminist, has had a lot of difficulty for many people that would like to say they were feminists but don't feel confident. I was kind of in that place when I was a younger person. But for years now, I've said I'm very comfortable with the term feminism, you know. But of late, I've understood that this glorious term, global feminism, which actually is an inclusive umbrella term that can include everyone from every walk of life, every gender, sexual orientation, and boys and men. So that a man who maybe feels uncomfortable, you know, he agrees with feminism, but he may be saying, maybe I can't say because maybe I'm not welcome. No, you're welcome. And you can call yourself a global feminist.
Yeah.
Learn, know the facts, know the stats, and help support women to evolve and to have their lives change their lives, transform their lives for themselves.
Welcome back. So that was Annie Lennox on International Women's Day, something that is really, really important because we still have a long way to go. And somebody who would probably agree with me on that is Angela Haggerty, who we've got on the phone. She's a Scottish journalist. Hello, Angela.
Hello. Hello. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm good. How are you?
I'm okay. So what would you say about the state of UK politics right now?
It's a catastrophe.
That's pretty blunt. What makes it a catastrophe? I mean,
it's an absolute catastrophe, and I don't think that people understand quite how serious it is, because obviously we're all fixated on Brexit, and is there going to be a deal, is there not going to be a deal? And that's relevant at the moment, given the situation that we're in. But there will be no return to normal after this. The UK can't return to normal because the UK is in a process of changing beyond recognition, I think. And we have seen a lot of this in the last few years due to the Scottish independence question. up here in Scotland, and it's clear to me that the kind of lines of division that we have now in the UK are not what they were traditionally. It's no longer about left-right. We're dealing with issues of sovereignty. And I think that it's not possible for the UK to return to normal politics. I don't think, though, that the politicians actually get that, because it's astonishing to me how quite often, politicians from Westminster, so they're predominantly kind of London-based, and it is a London bubble, they have such little understanding of what the mood in Scotland is like and the issues that we're dealing with up here, that I if I was a unionist, I would be very, very worried, because I don't think they understand the true nature of all of this. And if they don't understand it, then I think that the chances are that Scotland is going to become an independent country, that it will vote for independence. And I would be looking at places like Northern Ireland as well, where, you know, you're starting to see more of a feeling towards Irish reunification as a result of everything that's been going on. So it's not just about Brexit. The question needs to be, what happens next? And I don't think that the current crop of politicians that we have are equipped to deal with it.
Oh, 100%. I mean, if I was a Scottish nationalist, I would be kicking the fuck off right now, because after what happened in 2014, where we basically, well, David Cameron, went to Scotland and said, you need to vote to stay in the UK because otherwise you might have to leave the EU. And then exactly. 2 years later, we're dragging you out of the EU. It's absolutely unforgivable. And so if Brexit does actually happen, yeah, as you say, unionists should probably be very, very worried.
Yeah, I think so. And like I say, I don't really think that they understand how serious the situation is. Now, in Scotland, we've got, we have our own parliament, and the parliament has already voted through, you know, it's already given the First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, permission to ask for a second independence referendum. Now, the problem is that Westminster has made it pretty clear that it's going to say no to that. So we're going to find ourselves in a situation where our parliament, with politicians in it democratically elected by the people of Scotland and representing the people of Scotland, we're going to find that our parliament is then being told that it can't do something as monumental as this. And at that point, democracy has then failed. And I don't know what happens after that. I'm concerned about that, because you're in the realms of a democratic standoff there, with Westminster just saying no. And the SNP aren't going to just back down and say, oh, well, okay, then we asked. It will escalate from there. And I don't think anybody really knows what territory that's going to take us into, or how we deal with it.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I've discovered in the last few months is that, I mean, your stereotypical Brexit voting area is an area that has had very little investment from Westminster, an area that has seen industries close. And people often just think about that in terms of, like, your northeast England, your southwest, your Wales. But there are many towns like that in Scotland that have the same anger at a political system that isn't working for them. But they simply knew to blame Westminster rather than Brussels. And so and so the same anger exists there, not just the anger in terms of Scotland being basically overruled by Westminster, but also in terms of the fact that the same political frustration that led to the Brexit vote exists there and is still being frustrated.
Absolutely, and I see a lot of parallels. There's obviously a lot of differences as well between the Scottish independence debate and question and what happened with Brexit. But what you also find is that in Scotland, you know, we knew that we were going to be having this referendum in 2014. And for 2 years before that, we were having incredible conversations in Scotland. It absolutely dominated everyone. People were talking about it at work. They were talking about it in their social circles. And there were meetings on in every town across Scotland where people could go and find out more. And people, it led to a kind of a personal reflection for many people who had never really questioned how they feel about any of this. And so the nature of that was, you know, you hear a lot about division, but listen, you know, you had to be in Scotland. It was actually quite beautiful. People that had never had an interest in these things suddenly getting involved in their communities and thinking, do you know what, we actually could change this. We could change it, and here's how we could do it. The Brexit campaign was so different, and it was the arrogance of David Cameron that I just find incredible. Mm. I mean, what was the campaigning period? Like 6-8 weeks or something?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, how could you possibly have got to grips with the issues that people were going to be dealing with there? It didn't get to grips with any of the issues. And here we are 2 years later, and I think some people are only really now just starting to understand exactly, you know, how the EU works and what this means, what they actually voted for. So we've seen some massive differences, I think, and what we found in Scotland as well, another key difference, I think, with Brexit and something that has set us apart, you know, we're talking about things like sovereignty and nationalism, and that scares a lot of people, and I was one of those people, you know. Mm. Years ago I would have been on the no side for that reason and that reason alone. But in Scotland, for example, I didn't even vote in the independence referendum because I had moved to London just a few months before it for work. And the rule was that if you lived in Scotland, you had a vote. It didn't matter where you came from. Didn't matter if you hadn't lived in Scotland all your life. If you lived in Scotland at that moment, then it affected you and you had a vote. Now, that was, and so I respected that. I thought that was right. I didn't feel like I was entitled to vote because I am Scottish and my ethnicity. It wasn't about that. It was about practical thinking. Whereas in the Brexit vote, you know, we were having a vote that was going to affect, you know, all the lives of the EU citizens.
Yeah.
Some of them have been living and working here for years.
The people
and years
most affected by this didn't have a say.
Exactly, and they couldn't get to vote. So there was a much more ethnic kind of nationalism, I think, at play in Brexit that we didn't actually have in Scotland. And I think that there's, you know, some real key differences in the tone and the direction that the societies are going in. But I have to say, you know, I do laugh sometimes when, you know, people often would look at the Scottish independence question as being the thing that could be the catalyst for the breakup of the United Kingdom, you know, the collapse of the British Empire in full. And actually what we've seen is that it's the people of England and the way that they've used their vote that may indeed be that catalyst. And that's a really fascinating thing that probably nobody would have saw coming.
Absolutely. Regarding the notion of Scottish independence, my view's always been that Scotland should be as independent as Scotland wants to be, in terms of constitutional powers, devolution. However, I learnt to walk, speak, read, write in Dundee. My first crush was in Dundee. My first memories were in Dundee. So the idea of anything that creates a barrier between the people of England and the people of Scotland is something that I don't want to happen.
Sure.
So, I mean, what's your general view on what should happen in terms of Scottish independence regarding?
Yeah, I understand that and I relate to that, and I think that a lot of people who would have been no voters in Scotland also felt that way. That the idea that you were separating from something just didn't sit well with people, but they were won over in those arguments with the understanding that that's not. We're not dividing ourselves along sort of ethnic nationalistic lines here and putting, you know, this is purely about Scotland just being able to make its own choices over like political and financial matters and all of those things. And I too, you know, I've worked in England, I've got family in England, so there's. I'm kind of saddened by the thought of that separation, but at the same time, you know, we would be neighbours and we would continue to trade with each other and we would continue to have close links. I don't think anyone in Scotland would want this to be a sort of a hostile separation. I don't think it needs to be that. But the truth is that the system is not working, and a bit of kind of sadness over that separation isn't strong enough for people to just be able to ignore that. The system isn't working. The system is broken. The democratic mechanisms in the UK are not working for all of the people of the UK. And that's true for Scotland, but it's also true for, you know, those places like you mentioned, you know, those high Brexit leave towns, you know, places in the north of England. They feel as detached from Westminster as we do. And people in Northern Ireland and Wales, you know, you can't keep ignoring this.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I think politicians think that they can keep ignoring it.
And yeah, and just to move on to one other issue regarding inequality, International Women's Day. What would you, if you were to say one thing regarding International Women's Day and promoting the cause for feminism, what would you say?
Keep fighting.
Excellent. And Angela Haggerty, thank you very much. And thanks also to Dominique and Jermaine. This has been The Floor Is Yours. And happy International Women's Day. This will be available on Spotify after the show. See ya.
You've been listening to a FUBAR Radio podcast. For more information, go to FUBARradio.com.